Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Today we will be studying Sutta number 69 of the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Gulisani Sutta. Originally, I was going to skip over the sutta and not to discuss it. I thought it was a bit too monastic to discuss for a general audience. But then when I was looking it over last month, it struck me that it's actually a very interesting sutta and has some very, very important, it makes some very important points which are applicable not only to the monastic life, but I would say to any kind of lifestyle. And so I decided to include it. Okay, so this sutta begins with reference to a certain monk whose name is given as Gulisani. To my knowledge, he doesn't appear any place else within the Pali canon, only in this sutta, and nothing very much is said about him, except that he is described as a forest dweller of lax behavior, who had come on a visit to stay in the midst of the Sangha on some business or other. When the text uses the word, or when the translation uses the word business, it doesn't mean that he's conducting commercial business. It means that he had something to attend to. Maybe he had been ill and wanted to see a doctor, or had to discuss something with some of the other monks. Okay, and so because of his behavior, the Venerable Sariputta uses this, some of the incidents that occurred, as the basis for giving a discourse to the other monks. And he's speaking with reference to the behavior of this monk Gulisani. As we know, Venerable Sariputta was the chief disciple of the Buddha, the one who was foremost in wisdom. And so we find that in the Buddha's place, he often gives discourses himself. Okay, so Venerable Sariputta says, he addresses the monks as avuso, which is translated as friends, venerable friends. When a forest-dwelling bhikkhu comes to the Sangha, he comes to join the monastic community who might be living close to a town or a city, and he is living in the Sangha, he should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life. That is, he should be respectful and deferential towards his fellow monks. And so this opening sentence here is highlighting two different lifestyles that monks adopted during the Buddha's time, even today. One is the lifestyle of forest-dwelling monks. And it seems that he's referring specifically to a monk who lives alone in the forest, just in his own little hut, supporting himself by going on alms round and not socializing with the other monks. So this is one kind of lifestyle. The other kind of lifestyle is living in the midst of the Sangha. That is, one is living in a monastery where there might be it could be a small number of monks, a large number of monks, but this would be a monastery dedicated to the training of monks, a place where monks come together, share their experiences, practice together, study together, train together. Okay, so these were two types of lifestyles that monks would choose, and even today in Buddhist countries like Sri Lanka, Thailand, perhaps Burma, we have monks who choose these different lifestyles. Actually, the way I see it, from my experience, there would be three lifestyles of monks. One would be living in the Sangha in a large monastery, which is close to a town or city or inside a town or city. The second, which is not mentioned in this sutta, is living amidst the Sangha in a forest monastery. There are forest monasteries, monasteries located in the forest, somewhat far from the town or city, where one does have a community of monks living together. In Sri Lanka, they're usually small. It could be from 10 to 20 monks living in a forest monastery. And the third alternative is living alone in the forest. So we have the larger city or town monasteries, the small forest monasteries, and solitary dwelling places in the forest. And so when one is living in the Sangha, it could be living in the Sangha either in a town or city monastery or in a forest monastery. But the case of the monk who's being described here as the forest-dwelling bhikkhu, this would be probably a monk who's living alone in the forest. And the general prescription for training in the Buddha's teaching is that a newly ordained monk should spend preferably at least 5 years living in the midst of the Sangha, because it's part of the responsibility of a newly ordained monk to learn the monastic discipline, to learn the Dhamma, to learn how to associate with other monks, to learn from the other monks how to interact properly with the lay community. The Buddha's training or discipline, it's not the case where you just go to a temple, get ordination, and then go off to live on your own, thinking, I'm a great heroic meditator, I'm going to get enlightenment very quickly, and then without any training, without any preparation, without any study, one is ready to go off and live alone. But the Buddha recommends always spending 5 years at least during a period which is called in Pali Nisaya, which means literally guidance or dependence. During this period of Nisaya, one is living in association with elder monks, gaining instruction from them, guidance, learning how to behave properly as a monk. Because a monk is responsible, monk or nun, not only for his or her own spiritual development, but also when one takes the ordination, when one is wearing the monastic robe, one represents the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching in front of the lay Buddhist community, in front of the non-Buddhist community, even in front of the whole world. And so one has to behave in a way which will inspire the faith and devotion of those who are already following the Buddha's teaching, and also generate trust and confidence in those who are not Buddhists, but still expect a monastic person to behave in accordance with certain standards. People look at the monastic person as being a person leading a spiritual life, an ethical life, and so one has to exemplify that standard. One has to serve as a model for others. And for this reason, it's important to, for a monastic person to learn the proper ways of behavior in relation to other monks and in relation to the Buddhist lay community and in relation to the general community, so that people will have, even if they don't follow the Buddha's teaching, so that they'll admire and respect the Buddha's teaching and the Buddhist monastic community. Okay, and so one principle that's very strongly emphasized by the Buddha is establishing a certain order of respect and deference amongst the monastics. It's not the case where each monastic thinks, my opinion is right, my way of doing things is right. But monastics, they have to live together in peace and harmony. And this means that they have to have respect for one another and show deference from one to another according to a certain standard that the Buddha laid down. And this standard, maybe you might be surprised at this, it's not based on spiritual superiority. Of course, in one's heart or mind, one will respect those who seem to be most spiritually developed. But in the day-to-day way of conducting the affairs of the Sangha, deference, respect, is based on a simple principle of what's called seniority. So that each time after one's ordination, one passes one rainy season, that is the period in South Asia, lasts from the full moon of July to the full moon of October, roughly that period, for 3 months. Each time one completes the rainy season retreat, one gets 1 year of seniority. And so it's expected that those monks of greater seniority, even though they might not be the most enlightened monks, the wisest monks, but they will be the monks who have experience in the training. And so just because they've lasted so long and because they've gained this experience, one shows formal respect to them. Inner respect, of course, is a matter of one's own heart and mind. But in the basic formalities of monastic life, the standard is based on seniority. And so when a monk arrives in the monastery, the general principle is that the junior monk will pay respect to senior monks. If it's a senior monk who arrives in the monastery, then the junior monks in the monastery will pay respect to that monk. So the way this is done is by bowing down 3 times. And sometimes, if there's uncertainty who is senior to whom, what they do is ask about the date of ordination. And if this also applies not only to who bows down to who, but the seating in the dining hall is in order of seniority. And if there's some doubt who is senior to who, to whom, then they have to ask. I remember one time, this was shortly after I arrived back in the USA, 2002, I went to visit a friend of mine, another American monk who was living in a temple, a Thai temple near Chicago. This is Venerable Nyanasobindo. And after I had arrived there, a Thai monk came who was living there, but he had been away. And he looked young to me, so I assumed that time I was, I think, 29 years as a monk. And so I assumed that I was senior to him, so going to the breakfast, I sat ahead of him. We didn't have a chance to talk yet. But after breakfast, I asked him, when were you ordained? And he said, 1973, and I was ordained in 1973. Then I asked him, what month were you ordained? He said, May, and I was ordained in May. Then I asked him, what date in May? Then he said, May 17th. Then I got up, tuck out my cloth, bowed down to him, and said, I apologize, Venerable Sir. Please, you sit here, and I sit after you. Because my ordination was May 20th. So he was 3 days senior to me. But my ordination was originally fixed for May 17th. But something happened that day, so they couldn't hold the ordination on the 17th, so it was delayed till the 20th. If we were both ordained on May 17th, then I would have had to ask him, what time of the day were you ordained? If he said in the morning, then I would have said, please, Venerable Sir, you sit in front, I'll go behind you. If he said in the evening, then I would have been entitled to sit in front of him, because I was ordained about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay, so from the way a monk behaves when he comes into the midst of the Sangha, one can know from his behavior whether he's really been properly trained or not. So if he doesn't show any respect to the senior monks, and he seems rather even sometimes domineering and presumptuous in his behavior, one knows that he's not properly trained. So the text says, if he is disrespectful and undeferential towards his companions in the holy life, towards his fellow monks, particularly towards the senior monks, then there will be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes? That's a key phrase here. You know, just behaving according to his own will, not really following the discipline laid down by the Buddha. Since he is disrespectful and undifferential towards his companions in the holy life. Okay, so since there will be those who will criticize him in this way, a forest-dwelling monk who has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life. Okay, so this shows the first principle that has to be followed. And notice here, this is significant. The Venerable Sariputta, he's not beginning with high practices and high attainments, but with a very simple matter of how one conducts oneself in relation to others. So this, I think, is important. You could apply this. It's not only applicable to monastic life, but even also in relation to lay life, one should show respect and consideration towards others, not be arrogant and presumptuous, but always show consideration for others. That is an indication of a person whose mind is soft, gentle, open to others, a person with a kindly temperament. And so if one notices this tendency towards disrespect or lack of consideration for others, then one should try to change one's attitude and change one's way of behavior. And one thing we find in the West, there is a kind of attitude, everybody thinking, I'm just as good as everybody else. Why should I bow down to anybody else? But what I've found, living as a monk, that when one practices this, we call vandana, bowing down to senior monks, especially towards those who have good virtuous qualities, it brings a great deal of joy and happiness into the mind. It gives one a sense, on the one hand, it's like the head is considered to be the highest part of the body. So this is where the sense of self resides. And when one does this bowing, it's not that you regard the other person as a deity and that you're just humbling oneself before others, but it's or making oneself servile towards others. But it's a way of taking the head, the symbol of the self, the ego, and lowering it before those who have trained for a long time in following the Buddha's teaching, who have embodied within their character certain virtues like kindness, compassion, self-restraint, self-discipline, wisdom, mindfulness. And so when one bows down, it really means that one is lowering one's sense of ego or of self before the representation of these qualities. Similarly, when we bow down to the statue of the Buddha, it's not that we're bowing to a block of stone or a piece of wood, piece of clay, but we're respecting and venerating those qualities that the Buddha has embodied and that he represents: great wisdom, great compassion, great purity, great kindness. Okay, so now we come to the second principle here. When a forest-dwelling, I'll use the English word monk, comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be skilled in good behavior regarding seats. Thus, and then this is what is meant by good behavior regarding seats: I shall sit down in such a way that I do not encroach upon elder monks and do not deny new monks or junior monks a seat. Okay, so this is actually referring to what we call the proper sitting order, which I just spoke about before. Okay, when there is a meeting of the Sangha and the seats are arranged in a certain row, then the usual understanding is that the senior monk sits at the head of the row, and then each monk sits following him in the order of seniority. And so if there's a monk with 20 reins, say he's the eldest in the Sangha, he will sit in the first seat. Maybe there's a monk with 18 reins, he'll sit next to him, and maybe 16, 14 reins, 10 reins, 8 reins, 4 reins, 2 reins, and at the end, a monk with 1 reins, and then beneath the one with 1 reins, it could be the novices will sit also in their order of ordination. Okay, so what happens when one comes into the midst of the Sangha, if one doesn't know where one fits in the order of seniority, one makes the inquiry, but others will ask you, how many reins do you have? Then you tell them, and then they'll indicate the proper seat for you. And so when you're sitting, you should not encroach upon the seats of the elder monks, that you shouldn't take their seats. But one should take the position that's assigned to one. And yet one shouldn't deny new monks, junior monks, a seat. One should always make enough room on the bench or in the sitting hall so that the junior monks also can sit down. Okay, so then the text says, if he's not skilled in good behavior regarding seats, then others will criticize him for this. And so this is why the forest-dwelling monk who comes to the Sangha should be skilled in good behavior regarding seats. Okay, so these first two principles are concerned with the relation of the monk, the newly arriving forest monk, to other monks within the Sangha. Now we come to certain types of behavior that will reflect on the monk's relationship to the lay community. And since the monk, we always have to remember, represents not only himself, but the Sangha as a whole, since people judge the Sangha by the behavior of the monk, so the monk has to be careful in the way he interacts with the lay community. And so it says, when the forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should not enter the village too early or return too late in the day. That is, this applied especially in more ancient period. Now there are certain modifications because of modern means of transportation. Often activities take place in cities and towns in the evening, so the monk has to go there. But in the earlier generations, before the days of modern transportation, there would be a fixed time for the monks to go into the village or the town. They would go into the village or town on alms round. And so there would be usually a fixed period for the monastics to go into the village. It would differ from one area to another. For example, in Thailand, it's the common practice for the monks to go on their alms round as soon as it becomes light. So as soon as it's morning, could be 7 o'clock in the morning, the monks will go in, leave their monasteries, and go into the town or village with their alms bowls, going from place to place, from house to house, collecting food that people offer. In Thailand, because it's the custom for the monks to go on alms round, people often set up stalls in the streets in which they will keep a bowl of rice and then little packets of food. And as each monk goes by, they will offer some spoons of rice into the bowl of each monk and a packet of, could be some prepared vegetables or some other food. In Sri Lanka, it's generally not the custom for monks to go on alms round, but the monks can go, some monks do go on alms round. They can go pretty much at any time from about usually 8 a.m. till about 11:15 a.m. But then they're expected to go back to their temple or monastery and to finish the meal before 12 noon. Okay, so if the monk goes into the village too early, a time when it's not the normal time for going an alms round, or if he stays back too late, maybe sometimes people will invite the monk to come to their house for a meal, and so the monk can certainly accept the invitation, take the meal, but then if he stays a long time and returns late in the day, when the darkness is descending or after it's dark, and people become suspicious, the other monks become suspicious. What is that monk staying in the village or the town for such a long time? It's not proper for the monk to be staying out so long. And so then if he comes back, if he runs into the village very early before the generally agreed time for going on alms round, comes back too late, then other people will criticize him and the other monks will criticize him. Okay, then we come to the next principle. Okay, when the forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should not go before the meal or after the meal to visit families, to visit lay people. If he goes before the meal or after the meal to visit families, there will be those who criticize him for this. Okay, now this has to be properly understood. There's actually a subtext here which should be explained. It is proper, permissible for the monk to go to visit families before the meal or after the meal. But if he does so, he should report to another monk at the monastery that he's going to be going into the village or town to visit families. And so if he does this, it's permissible. He might have something to discuss with the families. They might ask him maybe to come in the evening, late afternoon or evening, to receive a gift. They might want to make some offering to this monk, or they might ask him to recite some suttas as a form of blessing, or they might ask him to give them some instruction in the Dhamma, or to give a discourse, a sermon. Sometimes they invite a number of neighbors and friends to join in. Okay, so the monk certainly can go after the meal to visit families, sometimes even to go very early to visit families. But if he does this, he has to inform another monk of this, so that it's not like he's behaving secretly, going off into the town or village. And then according to, there's a rule which says that an exception to this is during a season, part of the year, which is called the robe-making season. This is the period, it's about 4 months after the rainy season, from October till, I think it's February. During this period, you see in the Buddha's day, the monks usually, they didn't get robes that are ready made like this, but they got patches of cloth, because cloth was something very difficult to obtain then. We didn't have sewing machines and commercial processes of making cloth, so cloth was very difficult to obtain. So usually the monks would just collect pieces of cloth, which they would collect over this robe-making season, till they have enough pieces of cloth to make a new robe. Then they sew the patches of cloth into the shape of a robe, dye it, and then they can wear it as a robe. Okay, so during that season, it said that whenever one has to go to a family to get some pieces of cloth for a robe, one can go, and one doesn't have to report to another monk. Okay, now we come to some other teachings. Again, these are concerned with behavior within the Sangha. And this is, unlike the first two principles, seem to be concerned, the way I would see it, with the behavior that one displays when one immediately arrives in the midst of the Sangha. That is, when one arrives, one should show proper respect to the elders, and one should take one's proper seat within the community. But now, starting with section 7, we come to some modes of behavior that regulate what I would call constant conduct, perpetual conduct, when one is living together with other monks. And so, in paragraph 7, it said that when the forest-dwelling monk comes into the midst of the Sangha, he should not be haughty and personally vain. That is, he should not be arrogant and haughty in his behavior. He should not show that he has some kind of sense of personal vanity, but he has to be humble and, again, deferential and respectful to others. And then paragraph number 8 is concerned with speech. That is, one should not be rough-tongued, speaking harshly and roughly to others. And one should not be loose-spoken, just one who blabbers about anything that comes into his mind, just going on talking over and over again and again. But the Buddha says that monks, instructing the monks, he says, when you come together, you should either discuss the Dhamma or else maintain noble silence. And of course, if there are things concerned with the well-being of the community, then one should discuss these things. But when one comes in to the Sangha, there are certain topics one is not supposed to speak about. I think one finds them enumerated in Sutta 70. Starting at 76. These are the ways that it's said that the wanderers of the other sect speak, but this is also considered improper speech for the Buddhist monks. Talking about kings, talking about robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food and drink. I like this food, I like that to drink. Clothing, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles. What kind of car is that person driving? What kind of car are you driving? Villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, streets, wells. The dead? I don't know what's implied here. Trifles, the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or not so. So these are some of the topics that one has to avoid. So talk should be meaningful, pithy, concerned either with the affairs of the Sangha, with the Dhamma, with the discipline, the training, or else keep quiet. If one just indulges in gossip and loose speech, then the other monks will lose their respect for him. Okay, now we come to paragraph 9. Again, this is along the same line of proper behavior within the Sangha. It said, when the forest-dwelling monk comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be easy to correct and should associate with good friends. Being easy to correct, the word here is, the Pali word is suvaccho. That is, easy to speak to. That is, if other monks see one is behaving improperly, then they might call you for a private consultation and they'll say, Venerable, we want to point out, for example, that you were speaking rather roughly to the lay supporters, you were asking them to give you excessive portions of in the dining hall, excessive, again, you were demanding again and again that they give you third helpings and fourth helpings of that delicious pudding that they made, or you were joking in an improper way with these people, or anything that one is doing that's improper. So sometimes the elder monks will call up the junior monk and correct him. And so when one is corrected, the proper thing to do is to accept the advice of the senior monk, especially if one recognizes that he is well-trained and knowledgeable in the proper conduct of a monk. If somebody is advising you to behave wrongly, then, of course, one doesn't challenge him in a rough way, but one can retain what he's advising in mind and then go to consult some other monk who you think is a proper authority. But one doesn't argue back with the senior monk unless you think he's really advising you to do something wrong. Then probably if you're a visitor to this monastery, the right thing to do is to leave. And so, but the normal behavior is to accept good advice. Like when I first arrived in Sri Lanka, one of the first lessons I learned was how to eat the banana in the proper monastic way. Like I went to this place called Island Hermitage. This was the hermitage founded by Venerable Yenatiloka. And we were sitting in the dining hall, and then after the main course of the meal, the people serve the desserts, and there's banana. And so I tuck the banana, like in the American style, and pull open the skin, and then holding it in my hand, eat, you know, like this. So after the meal, one of the Sri Lankan monks who spoke English well came to me and he told me that in the monastic community, this isn't the way to eat the banana. In Sri Lanka, if you eat the banana like that, people will think, ah, this monk is like a monkey. So the proper way in Sri Lanka to eat the banana, what's considered the sort of dignified way, is to break off piece by piece the banana and put each little piece in the mouth and chew it. But I noticed some of the monks from the Chinese tradition eat the banana whole like this. So it could be that it's just a local custom. It doesn't really reflect anything that's laid down in the monastic discipline. So different countries have their own, sometimes their own local customs. But in order to conform with local custom, one should do things in the way that the other monks do things. Okay, so this is important when one is given advice. If one could see that it's the advice is offered with a good intention and appears to be correct, one should follow it. And then this is extremely important. One should associate with good friends. This is a theme that the Buddha emphasizes again and again, because we take on the characteristics of the people that we associate with. So one should find, whether one is a monk or a layperson, doesn't matter, but one should associate with, especially when one is following the Buddha's path, with other people who have following Buddha's precepts, who exemplify good behavior, who have respect and admiration for the teaching, people who embody the qualities, exemplify the qualities of loving kindness and compassion, those who show a sense of self-discipline, and those who exhibit wisdom and good judgment. One should avoid associating with bad friends, with people who violate the precepts, who are impulsive in their behavior, reckless in their behavior, and who are inclined to lead one down into wrong ways of behavior. And so if you feel that you're well established, then of course you could associate with people of bad behavior in order to instruct them and correct them. But if you hang out with them like they're they become your buddies and pals, then your behavior is likely to be subtly transformed by their ways of acting. And so in the early stages of one's training, one should associate with good people who can serve as models, good examples, and then one can follow them and gain inspiration and guidance from them. Okay, now, starting with paragraph 10, we come to some lines of guidance that are laid down, especially for those who have left the household life, for those who are undertaking the monastic training. So this is, a forest-dwelling monk should guard the doors of his sense faculties. See, here, the text is not speaking about one who comes into the midst of the Sangha, but just how the monk should behave, the one who's living in the forest. So he should guard the doors of the sense faculties, because if he doesn't guard the sense faculties, then he's just attracted to pleasant objects which will stimulate desire and craving, and then this will cause him to lose his self-discipline. Okay, so the text advises guarding the doors of the sense faculties, not letting the senses run freely amongst their objects, seeking beautiful things to see, beautiful sounds to hear, attracted to delicious food, but exercising restraint over the senses. Then paragraph 11 speaks about being moderate in eating. This is important especially for those who are dedicated to a life of meditation. Since if one eats too much, then one becomes drowsy, sleepy, and when one starts to practice meditation, the stomach is heavy, and one soon gives up and doesn't continue with the practice. And also from the standpoint of health, if one eats too much, then one starts to gain weight, one might become obese, and then that can cause health problems. And so if people see an overweight monk, then they wonder, is he restrained with his tongue or is he just indulging the craving for food? Okay, so one should be moderate in eating, not fasting for long periods and starving oneself, but eating what one needs to keep up the strength and health of the body, but avoid overeating. Then the forest-dwelling monk should be devoted to wakefulness. So what this means is that the monk who's living in the forest, dedicated to the meditative life, should be setting apart periods in the early evening for the practice of meditation, and early in the morning period for meditation. During the middle part of the night, of course, he lies down to sleep, but then early in the morning he starts the meditation, and then he continues the meditation, sitting, walking, throughout the day, of course, with some breaks for the meals, for bathing, to take a walk, and then continuing through the evening up to maybe about 10 o'clock. Then he could sleep from about 10 p.m. to 3 a.m., then up at 3 a.m., and again beginning the practice. Okay, then the forest-dwelling monk should be energetic. Actually, being energetic seems already implied, in my way of thinking, already implied by this wakefulness. But being energetic means that when one undertakes the practice of meditation, one brings forth energy and practices diligently, persistently, but patiently. Okay, then, paragraph 14, the forest-dwelling monk should be established in mindfulness. This is actually the key to the development of meditation, is to establish mindfulness. And so when one goes about doing one's day-to-day activities, one should be aware of what one's doing. One should have mindfulness set up. And then when one sits down to do the meditation, what is involved in the practice of the meditation is bringing awareness to one's subject of meditation. Setting up this awareness, that is what is meant by being mindful. Keeping one's object of meditation present before the mind. Okay, and so we could see here we have a progression taking place from energy to mindfulness. Those are really the two main factors in the practice of meditation. One is energetic in setting up mindfulness, and one practices mindfulness energetically, but not forcefully. If one is forceful, one will cause the mind to become restless and agitated. But it should be a kind of gentle energy, a soft energy. And that energy is applied to the task of keeping one's mind as continuously aware as possible of the object of mindfulness. Then, when the mindfulness is well established, the mind settles down and becomes concentrated. That is, one achieves what is called samadhi, the unification of mind, one-pointedness of mind. So now we're coming into the ideal level range here of, through the practice of mindfulness, gaining samadhi, concentration. And you could see here, actually, if you look at paragraphs 13, 14, and 15, do these three paragraphs remind you of anything that you've come across before? Tom?
Enlightenment factors.
Yeah, they're also enlightenment factors. I had something else in mind, but they're also enlightenment factors. That's what I was thinking of. The last three factors of the Noble Eightfold Path: right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Okay, then when concentration is well established, then one directs the mind to the development of insight. And it's insight that brings the arising of what we call panya, which is translated as wisdom. Okay, so the text says, a forest-dwelling monk should be wise. If he isn't wise, there will be those who would say of him, what has he gained by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is not wise? Okay, so people would criticize him for this, so a forest-dwelling monk should be wise. Here, I have to add that the text is speaking about a certain ideal standard, so one shouldn't look at, say, a monk who's living in the forest, practicing very sincerely, very earnestly, and maybe his faculties haven't ripened yet. So he hasn't gained a deep samadhi, hasn't gained higher wisdom. But if he is practicing earnestly, diligently, One could still admire him and one shouldn't criticize him. But this is setting the standard for the qualities that should emerge over time through dedicated practice. That is, through this practice of energy and mindfulness, over time there should arise concentration and wisdom. Now, it seems to me, this is my suspicion, but I have no way to verify this, that the original discourse may have ended with paragraph 16. Because it seems to me that this is the normal progression that we have from energy and mindfulness to concentration to wisdom, and then maybe from wisdom to liberation. But now there seem to be some other other aspects of the Buddha's life which are put in here which don't seem to be absolutely necessary. And so I have a suspicion, you know, since the suttas were transmitted orally over centuries, that in the course of oral transmission, other sections could have been added. I'll have to check. We have some parallels to the sutta in Chinese translation. I should have checked the Chinese version. Sometimes one could see the Chinese version might not have sections that are in the Pali version. Sometimes the Chinese version will have sections that are not in the Pali version. So we see here, there's a section, a forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the higher Dhamma and the higher discipline. The Pali words that are used here are Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. Now, Abhidhamma is a subject which became a collection of texts that was added to the transmitted teachings of the Buddha, and it became the third basket of the what's now called the Tripitaka, the three baskets of the teaching. So originally, there were the suttas, which was called the Dhamma, the Vinaya, the monastic discipline, and then at a later point, there was added the Abhidhamma Pitaka. And so some might think the Abhidhamma is mentioned here. This proves that the Abhidhamma existed at the time of the Buddha. But actually, the word Abhidhamma is used occasionally in the early texts, but we can't infer from this that it is referring to what is now called the Abhidhamma Pitaka. We could see very clear evidence that the Abhidhamma Pitaka was something which developed over a period of time, perhaps 150, 200 years from the time of the Buddha, as the teachings became systematized, expanded, elaborated, worked out in greater detail. So it seems to me that what is meant by the Abhidhamma in the context of the suttas, the early teachings, would be a kind of detailed discussion of the teaching that took place amongst the monks, not something taught by the Buddha to the monks, but we always find the word Abhidhamma is used in relation to discussions that take place among the monks themselves. And so it seems to be a kind of style of investigating the teaching in greater detail. And similarly, there's no collection called Abhivinaya. So it seems to me that what is meant by this term would be a more detailed discussion of the monastic rules that took place amongst the monks, where it was decided what is the exact meaning of the rule, how do the rules apply in this situation, that situation, what are the exceptions to the rule, and so on. Okay, so this section is saying that the forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the higher Dhamma. We could say the more detailed explanations of the Dhamma and the more detailed explanation of the Vinaya, the discipline. And you see, that section, this is why I think some sections were added later. It doesn't quite fit into the sequence here, because we have the progressive stages of meditative development, from mindfulness to concentration to wisdom, and then coming to the study of the detailed study of the Dhamma and discipline doesn't fit into a natural progression. Then we come to paragraph 18. Here, the forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to those liberations that are peaceful and immaterial, transcending forms. This is referring to the formless meditations, the states beyond the four jhanas, the four formless meditative absorptions. And now, strictly, these formless meditations are not necessary for gaining enlightenment and liberation of mind. There are four additional states which can be achieved by those who have special skill, special facility in samadhi, in concentration of the mind. And it's interesting that paragraph 17, paragraph 18, these are intended to prepare the monk to answer questions that others will ask of him. That's introducing a new idea here that we don't find in the earlier sections. People will ask you about the discipline, about the doctrine, so you should be able to answer their questions. Here, people will ask you about these formless meditations, you should be able to answer their questions. Okay, then we come to paragraph 19, which is concerned with what is called gaining a superhuman state. Okay, what is meant here by the superhuman state, normally this will refer to any kind of deeper meditative attainment, like the jhanas, the different stages of samadhi, the formless meditations, the higher realizations of wisdom, and especially the stages of awakening or enlightenment. The four stages of stream entry, once returning, non-returning, arhatship. But here, since we've already had mention of concentration, wisdom, and the formless meditations, here I would understand the superhuman state to be referring specifically to the four stages of enlightenment. So it seems the sense is that the forest-dwelling monk should apply himself to the superhuman state. Not necessarily the case that he has to be one who's attained them, though that's the ideal, but he should be practicing the way to one of these superhuman states. And again, this is a little strange. The reason so that he could answer questions that others might ask about them. Okay, so these are the things that Sariputta says the forest-dwelling monk should master. Then when Sariputta finishes speaking, then his friend Venerable Mahamoggallana asks him, he says, should these things be undertaken and practiced only by the forest-dwelling monk? What about a monk who is living near a village? And then Sariputta says, those things should be undertaken and practiced not only by the forest-dwelling monk, but also by the town-dwelling monk. So whether one is living in the forest or in a town, one should undertake all of these practices. Okay, and that takes us to the end of the Gulisani Sutta. So if you have any questions, then please feel welcome to ask. Okay.
The 5 hours a night of sleep, is that a standard for just the far? I mean, it's both.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's an interesting question. And what I found, others have found, when one is doing intensive meditation, the need for sleep diminishes. So one could get by even 5 hours is more, sometimes more than necessary. 4 hours, 3 hours can become sufficient. The mind just goes into a very deep state of sleep, and even without an alarm clock, can just come out. One gets completely refreshed and can come out after, usually at the beginning, after maybe one starts with 6 hours, but as one goes on, one could work it down to 5 hours, 4 hours, even to 3 hours.
So there's no real, it depends on the monk.
Yeah, yeah. And if one is not doing like the full-time meditative life, then generally 5 hours might not be sufficient. So one has to choose what is suitable for one's own, you know, bodily constitution, not forcing oneself to become exhausted, worn out, tired during the day. Yeah, I mean, often it's the practice, even for the monks who are observing this very strenuous regime, to take a very short nap in the early afternoon, shortly after the lunch. It's said that the nap should be the length of time that it takes if you, this is for a monk who has just a little bit of hair growing, if he washes, takes a bath, and the hair gets wet, the amount of time that the hair takes to dry. Since they didn't have minute clocks in those days, it could be about 15 or 20 minutes, not more than a half an hour. What I found, again, one doesn't even have to set the alarm, but if one just lies down, the mind descends into this nap for 15, 20 minutes, and then just comes out automatically. If one thinks I'm going to take a nap like that, lies down at 1 p.m., then wakes up and looks at the clock, and it's 3 p.m., maybe better not to take the nap. Yes, please.
Why do you think it's set up so that it says, since there would be those who would say of this, of him, it seems like it would be self-evident. Why is it that, like it's the opinion of people, yeah, that you should act this way? Why is it self-evident that you should act this way?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think one should take it, it's also self-evident that one should behave that way. But maybe my guess would be that it could be the case that you see that this forest dweller who's living alone in the forest is used to this solitary style of life, so he's not under the observation of others. And because he's gotten used to be acting in any way that he wants without coming under the observation of others, it's important to remind him that when you come into the midst of the Sangha, others are going to be observing you, either your fellow monks or the lay people that you depend on. And so even if you're not concerned with your own well-being, but you have to remember that the reputation of the Sangha depends on your behavior. And so for that reason, you should behave properly. That's just my guess. Okay, there was a question in the back. Yeah.
It also struck me, though, that the whole sutta, in a way, tackles the whole Eightfold Path.
That the whole sutta...
The whole sutta seems to address the entire Eightfold Path, because the first 11 are about conduct.
Yeah.
So that's sila.
Yeah.
And then 12 through 15 are about the process related to samadhi.
Yeah.
Yeah,
actually, that in a way, that definitely that's so. But what I had in mind was that these factors 13, 14, and 15 specifically mention the factors of the Eightfold Path. Being energetic is, well, the word used is virya, but that's a synonym for vayama, which is right effort. And then we have being established in mindfulness, that's sama-samadhi, right mindfulness, and being concentrated, samahita, that implies samadhi, right concentration. And so, in a way, all of the factors of training mentioned in the sutta can be fit into the Eightfold Path, but these three factors correspond quite exactly to those three factors in that same sequence of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, George.
I wonder about the tradition of the forest dwellers.
Are
they like hermits? Do they live alone by themselves in the deep forest? Or how do they feed themselves?
Okay, yeah, this is an important question. You see, the monastic is not allowed to cook or prepare, this is in the Theravada tradition, not allowed to prepare their own food. So those who are living even in the deep forest will make it a point to live at least close enough to a village on which they can depend to collect alms, to which they can go on alms round. So even when they're living deep in the forest, they will still be within the reasonable walking distance of a village, well, if it's the deep forest, it's not close to a town, but there will be little hamlets or villages, and so they can go on their alms round to the village. If in some cases, this is what is done in Sri Lanka, if there is not just one monk, but a group of monks living in a forest monastery, a system is worked out whereby it could be on a monthly schedule or an annual schedule. Take an example, the annual schedule. There'll be an office connected with the forest monastery, and then people from particular villages throughout the whole country, like Sri Lanka, they will register with the office to give alms at that monastery on one particular day out of the year. So say it could be that they reserve for themselves, let's say January 17th. So the way this is done on January 16th, what they do is they'll take some vehicles or rent a bus, and the whole group of supporters will go to the forest monastery, and there'll be a kind of hall outside the area where the monks live, which is called the the pilgrimage center, something like that. So the lay people stay there, will stay there overnight. Early in the morning, they might send up some breakfast to the monks' section of the monastery, and then the monks will take their breakfast. Then, in the middle of the morning or later in the morning, the monks will come down single file from the monks' section of the monastery. They come down to the pilgrims' section with their alms bowls, as though they're going on alms round in the village. And during the course of the morning, the lay people would have prepared the food, and then the monks go by, and then the lay people offer them the food into their bowls. Then most of the monks will go up and go back into the monastery, but one monk will stay behind and then give a discourse, a Dhamma discourse, to the lay people. Any further questions? Okay, first Sandy, you had your hand up.
What is the reason behind the rule that one monks are not allowed to prepare food for themselves?
I think this was particularly applicable in ancient India, because in India, during the Buddha's time, wandering ascetics, monastics, renunciants were considered part of the Indian religious scene, the spiritual scene. And so it was the common practice for all of these wandering ascetics, renunciants, generally to depend for their livelihood on the offerings of people. And then this has another function within the Buddhist tradition, and that is that it sets up a kind of close, integral relationship between lay people and the monastics. So if the monastics were just living in remote monasteries preparing their own food, then people would not get the chance to see the monastics, to have any kind of contact with them or relations. But the Buddha had said this is one of the ways in which he's faring for the welfare of the world, and that is by having the monks live in dependence upon the lay community. And so when the monks, nuns, have to go on their alms round and collect the food that's offered by lay people, or lay people come to the temple and either prepare the food for them there or bring food that's already cooked, then it establishes a relationship of trust, affection, respect, dedication, devotion between the Buddhist monastics and the laity. Things were changed in some of the East Asian countries, like in China, because there, let's say, the political, social situation became quite different for Buddhists during certain periods of Chinese history. Probably during the Tang Dynasty, I would assume, when Buddhism became well established in China, perhaps the relationship between the monastics and the lay community was very similar to that in India, even though there was not the old tradition of making offerings to monastics. But during some of the later dynasties, when the other religious groups would turn the king and the government against Buddhism, then the Buddhists were persecuted, and even large numbers of monasteries were destroyed, and the monks would have to flee from the cities and towns and go remote into the remote mountains. And in those conditions, then they took the practice of even growing their own crops and preparing their own food. And this was particularly the practice in the Chan or Zen school. And so in this way, it was the Chan or Zen school which preserved Buddhism in China by going into the mountains and then abandoning that kind of practice, which was no longer feasible, but instead storing, growing, and cooking their own food.
I actually have a second question.
Yeah.
When a monk decides to go
Yeah.
Alone, does he need to have kind of permission from the senior monk?
Does he have to have permission from a senior monk? I would say, if this is a junior monk who wants to live in the forest, the correct procedure would be for him to get permission from his teacher or from the senior monk in the monastery where he's been staying. But if it's a mature monk who's already completed his basic training, then he doesn't have to get permission. He could just do this on his own. Kim, did you have a question? Yeah, the way I see it, the stages of enlightenment actually are what follows from the Noble Eightfold Path. So the Noble Eightfold Path is the path or way, but then sometimes we see two other factors added to the Noble Eightfold Path to make 10 factors. That is right knowledge. This would be the knowledge of enlightenment. And then this is followed by right liberation. That's the liberation that is achieved as a result of right knowledge. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to end for the day. So today is November 3rd, so I'll have another class next Tuesday, November 10th. And next Tuesday, I'm going to do Sutta number 71, which will not take much time. You could see it's only 2.5 pages. So it might even just take 15 minutes to do Sutta 71. And then we'll go to Sutta 72, which is very interesting and fairly difficult sutta. Okay, so we end by sharing the merits, the good karma. We share the merits with the deities who protect the Dharma, the Buddhas or fear spirits, and with the world and with all living beings. So I'll do the chanting in Pali. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu. Sabbe bhutanumodantu. Sabbe satanumodantu. Sabba sampatti siddhya.